Hello, and welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the only podcast in America where $3.5 trillion is still a heck of a lot of money. I'm Peter Suderman, filling in for Matt Welch, who only, I repeat, only books flights on Mondays. Today, I'm joined by my regular co-panelists, Catherine Mangu Ward and Nick Gillespie, as well as my estimable colleague, Eric Baim. Everybody say hello.
Howdy.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, guys. So today we're going to talk about the infrastructure deal and the budget deal, which are actually the same thing, as well as a reader question about vaccine mandates. And we're going to talk about the chaos in Afghanistan and where American foreign policy goes from here. But before that, let's hear from a sponsor. If you're like me, keeping up with the news has become a real pain. All the best news sites are locked behind paywalls, and the free stuff is just clickbait and fake news that no one should waste their time on. Imagine an app where you can get unlocked access to the reliable news sites, an app that filters out fake news and clickbait, but still shows you every story from multiple perspectives to counter bias, where good news, as in positive stories, is highlighted so you don't become despondent, and where journalists dig through news around the world to find stories you wouldn't normally see. That's what an innovative Australian startup called Inkl, I-N-K-L, has come up with. Inkl.com has signed partnerships with 100-plus news sources like The Economist, The Atlantic, and Bloomberg, and it has created a unique system combining journalists and algorithms to create a best-of-news feed. The service unlocks more than $12,000 of premium news for $100 a year. If you go now to Inkl.com/podcast, they'll give you an additional 25% discount so you can get a whole year's worth of headache-free news for just $75. That's Inkl.com/podcast. Okay, I want to start with the situation in Afghanistan. It's not great. After 20 years at war, more than $1 trillion in spending, and nearly 2,500 American casualties, President Joe Biden is withdrawing U.S. forces from Afghanistan. And the immediate consequences so far look pretty grim. Taliban forces have overrun Afghanistan's major cities, including the capital, where the president has fled. The country's government has effectively fallen. U.S. diplomats, meanwhile, have been destroying sensitive materials, burning U.S. flags so they aren't used as propaganda materials. The Taliban has acquired many U.S. Military vehicles, including Humvees. We've been airlifting people out of the country in scenes that some say recall the fall of Saigon. The chaos has led some Biden critics and foreign policy hawks to issue harsh condemnations of the U.S. anti-war movement. Texas Republican Dan Crenshaw, for example, posted the following. Honestly, kind of entertaining to watch the No More Endless War crowd struggle to figure out who to be mad at. Politicians, generals, warmongers, Biden. Biden did what you wanted, Crenshaw says. When your entire foreign policy is built upon an emotional slogan, this is what you end up with. Later, Crenshaw also posted that the No More Endless War crowd, phrase he likes, has zero ability to distinguish between nation building and a security presence to deny terrorists safe havens. Nick, you have been against the war in Afghanistan for longer, I suspect, than at least some of our listeners have been alive. You are a longtime member of what Crenshaw calls the No More Endless War crowd, and I believe a proud one. Is libertarian foreign policy just built on an emotional slogan?
I don't think so, but I do think that the past 20 years plus of American foreign policy certainly are. And it was in the wake of 9/11 that we had to do something. And part of that, I think, rightly meant going after bin Laden and the people responsible for 9/11 who were housed in Afghanistan, which is why we ended up showing up there. And then the emotions kind of, are very good to like, okay, let's go get revenge. And then what are we doing? The fact is, and this is something that the Bush administration understood in the Afghanistan papers, the secret ongoing history of failure and of absolute failure in Afghanistan, even while Donald Rumsfeld was still running the show. We knew this was a failure from the beginning because we didn't have a clear conception of what we were doing in Afghanistan. It's interesting to talk about security presence versus nation building. I suspect if you go back to when he was in his diapers, he would have been in favor of nation building and talking about it now. Now he's saying something different. But I think this is a horrible day for the Afghanistan people. It is also a good day for America and for Joe Biden, not because we can't be doing more for people who are displaced by the war, which we help to maintain and extend and continue forever and ever. But this is the best thing that Joe Biden has done as a president, which is to get us out of Afghanistan, where we didn't know what we were doing, and we were just putting ourselves and other people in harm's way.
Catherine, Nick says this is the best thing that Biden has done as a president. He is crediting Biden, but a lot of the discourse I am seeing is about who to blame. There's obviously just a lot of it going around. There's going to be a lot of 2020 hindsight here. Just glancing at my Twitter feed, which turned out to have a surprisingly large number of foreign policy and international security experts in it, I saw the following, a couple of quotes going around this weekend. You know, there was Trump saying just about a month ago or so, "I started the process. All the troops are coming home." And he's referring to Biden here, "they couldn't stop the process. 21 years is enough. The Biden administration couldn't stop the process. They wanted to stop it, but they couldn't stop the process." And in July, meanwhile, there was an exchange in which a reporter said to Joe Biden that the U.S. intelligence community, which, you know, nominally reports to the president and is like his to control, has said that the Afghan government was set for collapse as we were going to pull out of the country. And Biden just rejected this idea, saying, no, that's not true at all. And obviously, it's kind of wrong. The government has collapsed. So one thing you can say is that both of the last two presidents, both Biden and Trump, have their fingerprints on this in different ways. Catherine, who is to blame? Who is to credit? And are you personally struggling to figure out who to be mad at?
I never struggle to figure out who to be mad at because I'm always mad at the government, Peter. And this is a great example of how governments do things, which is to say they do something they probably shouldn't have even tried to do in the first place. They do it inadequately. They draw down from doing the thing inadequately. Then when people get angry and upset, they redouble their efforts and do the thing they shouldn't have been doing anyway more, but still badly. Then they do it less again. Then they do it more again. And then they, with no particular warning, pull out of whatever they were doing, leaving confusion and despair in their wake. This is true. Honestly, I think you will find of many, many, many things governments do. But it is especially true of modern warfare. Listen, it's the Spider-Man pointing at Spider-Man meme out there, right? Like, everybody knew that this was going to be a disaster when we pulled out. Everyone knew that. And there are an awful lot of people suddenly willing to go on the record saying they always knew this was going to be a disaster. All of the newspapers' front pages today are full of experts and people on the ground saying, we definitely did a really terrible job of training armed forces there. We did a terrible job of establishing Western norms. We did a terrible job of actually rooting out the Taliban. We knew that this was a mess. Also, all the front pages of the newspapers are full of people saying we had to get out, except the people, the hawks, who have said we can never get out. And, you know, that element of it, I think I'm just clearly on the side of team we had to get out. And I'm not yet willing to say that this is the best thing Biden has done, because I am not yet convinced that Biden will fully do this thing. I think there is still a chance. I was optimistic until this week that he was just going to hold firm, even if the consequences were negative. I now think that there is a chance that he, like so many before him, will begin a drawdown and then not quite finish the job. So I'm going to withhold judgment.
Eric, this was a big multi-year, multi-decade, really, military effort, which is to say it was a big government project, which naturally means it was incredibly expensive. Just talk us through some of the fiscal impact of the war, the cost, the context for the cost, how did this impact federal spending, taxation, our ability to do other things, perhaps, with federal revenue?
Yeah, well, a lot of the cost was obviously just put on the national credit card, for one thing. I mean, we didn't raise taxes to pay for the war. In fact, President George W. Bush, who launched the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq and the war on terror globally, cut taxes, right? So, I mean, we never really paid for this cost. And in fact, the Associated Press has a really helpful breakdown of this that they published over the weekend. So the estimated cost, the direct cost of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq rolled together because they were basically budgeted as a single entity for a large portion of their execution, is about $2 trillion. Almost all of that was debt financed. And then they point out, the Associated Press helpfully points out, that because it was debt financed, the estimated interest costs between now and 2050 will be an additional $6.5 trillion. So when you see that $2 trillion figure bouncing around social media today, keep in mind that that's only what we've, you know, already paid, and then we still have to pay off significantly more than that, and we will be paying for the cost of this war for a long time to come. Again, from the Associated Press, helpful sort of tidbits here without getting too deep into the numbers. President Harry Truman raised top tax rates to pay for the Korean War by 92%. Lyndon Johnson raised top tax rates to pay for the Vietnam War by
92%.
The amount that that the tax rates were raised, that the top tax rates were raised, was by 92%. Then the same thing for the Vietnam War, 77% increase to top tax rates. Now, we're not advocating for raising taxes on this podcast, of course. Presidents shouldn't do that. It's good to have low taxes. But if you're going to have a 20-year war that costs trillions and trillions of dollars, you need to have a plan to pay for that. There was never a plan to pay for this, and it's a cost that we will continue to pay for a long time to come. The ongoing health, disability, burial, and other costs related to the roughly 4 million veterans that have served in the Afghanistan-Iraqi wars are estimated to cost the United States another $2 trillion over the rest of their lifetimes. So this is a war that not only did it cost us a ton of money to execute for apparently no significant accomplishment, really. I mean, we're leaving the country largely as we found it 20 years ago, maybe minus the Al-Qaeda operations there. And we're going to continue to pay for it, you know, for decades to come. And then I think, just to sort of round back to the question of, like, who is to blame for this? Biden is going to take a lot of heat, obviously, in the short term. But I think two things are possible. I think it's possible that Biden is completely right about the big picture situation here, that if we left 10 years ago or we left 10 years from now, things would be exactly the same. And so I think he's totally right about that. And I think the failures in Afghanistan are bipartisan in nature. They go back over multiple administrations, obviously. But the sort of short-term failures, and in particular, the failures to get the thousands of people out who helped the U.S. conduct this 20-year war, the inability to sort of handle the logistics of this drawdown, and how bad that looks now, that I think you can lay both, not entirely at the Biden administration's feet, but at both the Trump and Biden administration's feet.
If I may, that's the one thing that America should feel, you know, embarrassed by or ashamed of, is not dealing with the people who were our allies there and who we also made extensive promises to for their help and their cooperation in prosecuting the war. And we did the same thing in Iraq, and we've, you know, it's, this is something that everybody in the country should be deeply shameful of, that we have a government that goes and invades and occupies and destroys other countries, making promises all along the way that they just absolutely, resolutely fail to deliver on. That's the only thing that is problematic here. Biden is not going to suffer politically from pulling out. There's a bunch of idiot war hawks in the Republican Party, somebody like a Dan Crenshaw, and a bunch of nattering nabobs of idiocy in the press who are trying to spin this as a disaster. And remember how bad it was when America left Vietnam, et cetera. You know, the point of the fact, in point of fact, nobody is in favor of the Afghanistan war. Nobody has been in favor. Everybody understands that the global war on terror was a hysteria, which ultimately was not even delivering votes, much less anything related to security of America, of Americans in our country or abroad. So Biden will, you know, and I don't even want to put it in this kind of context, but Biden will benefit from actually being the guy who got us out of a ridiculous situation, which, of course, he was in favor of when he was a senator, et cetera, all of that. There's a lot of hypocrisy to go around. The important thing is that we had to leave. We're out. And now the only thing we should be debating is, how do we actually help the people who we made promises to get them out of harm's way? And that's really what we should be discussing, I think, as a country.
Yeah, there was a recent Reuters headline: in desperation, U.S. scours for countries willing to house Afghan refugees.
Yeah. Now we don't have
space.
Right,
so
where could they go? So it does look like the Department of Defense is going to house some number of refugees at military installations. But right, it's like where in the world could American policymakers find a large open country that they have some influence over, where they could perhaps put some people, you know? So Catherine, I want to go to you next. Just on the question of cost, there's the fiscal cost, which Eric talked about, but there's also time. And time is life, right? In a way that sort of, time's life, right? But like how you spend your, but it's really Whoa. True that how you spend your days is how you spend your life. And a lot of people spent a lot of days in Afghanistan. You and I both came of age in parallel with 9/11 and the wars that followed, right? It happened while we were in college. I certainly knew people who were deployed, knew people who devoted significant chunks of their lives, just years, to the war effort. I grew up in a military community. And this was a huge project backed by huge American man and woman power. And so I guess my question is, was any of it worth it? Did we get anything from this? And was there ever a reason for the U.S. military to be in Afghanistan at all?
I think that's I'm trying to sort of treat that question like as generously as possible, because my instinct, of course, was to say, no, it was totally worthless. Screw this. But, you know, one thing that I do remember, like I was just barely old enough to remember in the conversation about going into Afghanistan that a lot of old foreign policy hands said Afghanistan has defeated better nations than ours, essentially, that we would be quite likely to be joining a long, long line of global would-be empires that stubbed their toes on Afghanistan. And I am struck by how very, very, very right those people were. And there were lots of them. It's not as if it was just, you know, Sheldon Richman alone shouting that war was bad no matter what, and everyone else thought this is a great idea. People who knew what they were talking about knew that Afghanistan was a huge risk, a gamble, and likely to fail. Yet, I also remember the overwhelming bipartisan consensus to go in and go in hard and teach them a lesson, gosh darn it. And so, you know, I think the other thing that I am struck by is all these people who are now saying, I knew that Afghanistan was a bad idea and that it was doomed from the start. Yes, those people existed. They're the people I just described, as well as principled anti-war folks. But most of everyone with power, and also most voters, were quickly and casually pretty strongly in favor of going into Afghanistan and Iraq as well. I am currently editing an article by Brian Doherty about the Patriot Act, whose anniversary is also upon us. And I think that if we are doing a calculus of the total cost of the war and its associated events, we have to think about that stuff too. Now, the Patriot Act arguably was much more a consequence of 9/11 than the war in Afghanistan itself. But if the whole thing is just a big cluster, there are not only the costs of man hours, there are not only the promises broken, there is not only the U.S.'s global reputation at stake, but also, the costs to Americans who never went to Afghanistan and who were not directly involved in the war, but who ended up caught in various national security dragnets.
You know, it's worth pointing out that out of Congress, and include the House and the Senate, one person voted against the authorization of use of military force after 9/11, and that was Barbara Lee of a progressive Democrat from California. That gives you an indication of how unanimous the country was, the leadership of the country in saying that we needed to do everything possible, which in that context meant going into Afghanistan. I think there is a case that, we asked the Taliban, who we had played footsie with, at various points before we deposed them, to deliver or allow us to pursue bin Laden. They didn't. I think there was a strong argument that we were right to invade Afghanistan in pursuit of bin Laden. We obviously lost that trail. But then this idea of nation building, which everybody was in favor of, you know, in the early 2000s. And that's the fever dream that has broken. And I, among all of the other tragedies coming out of this, the worst aspect is if we don't actually reconfigure American foreign policy in a post-Cold War era, in a post-9/11 era, where we're not talking about doing the same things over and over again under different names with the exact same failed results.
I do want to move on here, but before we do, Nick, I want to ask you one more question. Do you think that this makes America less safe? Because that's an argument that that people who think we should stay are making, is this is 2,500 troops.
Yep.
We're not there to do nation building. We are there to fight the Taliban on their turf rather than on ours. And this has been an argument.
This is also the argument, speaking of the Patriot Act, why, you know, we needed to break a bunch of prostitution rings using the Patriot Act that were, you know, acting out of limousine services in Las Vegas. Without that, you know, we would be wide open to terrorist attacks. You know, the fact of the matter is, the way that you go after terrorists is by having actual intelligence services that track this kind of stuff, not bombing other countries and destabilizing entire regions, which is what we've done. You know, are we safer or less safe after destroying the Middle East and rejiggering everything there? I don't know. You know, like, I tend to think not. And what keeps us safe are, you know, the actual targeted infiltration and understanding of terrorist cells. You know, the Taliban was not coming to America to bomb the World Trade Center. You know, that was something different. We had the intelligence for that. This is the other thing, is that when we start talking about, oh, we've got to be over there in order to keep them from coming over here, then we're not paying attention to all of the massive intelligence failures that, you know, precede virtually every major act of, you know, kind of international terrorism.
I do worry that people are going to misread if something, God forbid, does happen on U.S. soil in the next, I don't know, year, 2 years, right? Like, you know, this idea that somehow, because we were doing these wars, that is correlated with, connected with, causal of the fact that there hasn't been another major terrorist attack on U.S. soil. You hear that all the time from people who should know better. Terrorist attacks are incredibly rare. Their distribution is essentially random across our timeline. People may be trying and failing. They may try and succeed. Maybe not too many people are actually trying. If something happens in the next year or year and a half, I think it's going to be really hard, but also really important to contextualize that and say, this is not because we pulled out of Afghanistan, because it won't be.
Yeah, the flip of that is also that there were these cases in the 90s, you know, because it's kind of like everybody, you know, starts history with 9/11, but the Clinton administration, which was a very bellicose administration, they deployed tons of troops in small numbers all around the country, more so than Ronald Reagan did in the, you know, what turned out to be the twilight of the Cold War. You know, we were bombing places in Afghanistan, in Kenya, you know, around the globe in order to stamp out specifically bin Laden. We changed our disposition towards getting rid of him, getting rid of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. So, you know, we should do a kind of assessment of foreign policy, at least since the end of the Cold War, before we start embarking on whatever next adventure is, you know, is going to be plausible in the court of public opinion.
All right, let's move on
to
our...
That requires just taking the nation building issue completely off the table, right? Like, I just as the final point here, Peter, I would just recommend everybody to check out a piece the Washington Post published over the weekend. Afghan Security Forces Wholesale Collapse was years in the making. It's this long form piece by Craig Whitlock that talks about the $85 billion that we spent trying to build up this army, this 300,000 strong Afghan army, supposedly that Biden, even just as recently as a few weeks ago, said was going to be able to stand up to the Taliban. And then it just, you know, it completely fell apart in a matter of a couple of days. But it goes back all the way to 10 years ago, to 2011 is where the story starts, and just sort of shows that, you know, another decade of time in Afghanistan didn't get us, you know, any further than we were then. So, you know, I don't know what another decade was going to get us. Anybody who makes that argument, I think, is just completely making it up.
Okay, so while we are on the topic of building things that might fall apart,
You've done that, Welsh Proud.
Yeah. Hey, guys, you know what it was last week? But for real this time, it was Infrastructure Week. Really, it was actually infrastructure week. The Senate passed the bipartisan infrastructure bill, a $1.2 trillion package with about $550 billion in new spending. 19 Republicans, including Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, joined Senate Democrats to vote in favor of this bill. It now moves on to the House, where it is already being viewed in tandem with a $3.5 trillion partisan spending bill focused mostly on social spending. So, Eric, actually, I want to start with you here. Republicans who voted for this, for the infrastructure bill, kept saying it would be paid for. They said this over and over again, that it wouldn't add, to paraphrase a recent president, it wouldn't add a single dime to the deficit. So my first question is just, is that true? But my sort of bigger picture question here is, how much should we as libertarian limited government types actually be focused on the deficit at all? Because it's possible to imagine a $1 trillion bill or even a $10 trillion bill that doesn't add to the deficit, but it would still be a $10 trillion bill. So how should we be thinking about that sort of thing?
Sure. I mean, I think the debt and the deficit are things that libertarians, and not just libertarians, but all Americans should actually care about. And just for the record, we're now running, we're on pace to run a $3 trillion-ish deficit again this year. And it's going to be more than $1 trillion basically every year for the foreseeable future, according to the CBO and groups like that. To answer your more acute question, though, Peter, I mean, yes, the infrastructure bill as currently written, they say it will be paid for. It's not actually going to be paid for. The CBO says that the infrastructure bill would add about $250 billion to the deficit over the next 10 years. Of course, like any big piece of legislation that comes out of Washington, there are all sorts of little gimmicks in the infrastructure bill that are pay-fors that aren't actually pay-fors. And so the real number is probably something like $400 billion over 10 years. That is not terrible as federal spending in the last couple of decades goes, and in terms of blowing up the deficit. And if if it wasn't an infrastructure bill, and large portions of this bill actually are focused on infrastructure things that will help the economy, that will ultimately have multipliers and things like that. If you have bigger roads and more bridges, you can have more traffic and do more economic stuff. And so you end up with growth. And this is kind of the argument for doing this type of legislation anyway. So all of those caveats aside, we're definitely adding to the deficit. And then as you pointed out, and I guess I'll just throw the hot potato back to you, the infrastructure bill is really just kind of the first piece of this two-piece legislative puzzle, the second one of which is far, far, far worse when it comes to not just the size of government and the things that government will do, but also the amount of deficit spending that we're going to do.
Yeah, so Catherine, as Eric says, most of the spending in this bill is actually focused on roads and bridges and waterways, actual infrastructure, stuff that people might actually used to get from here to there. And like, there are multiplier effects in theory, just like when you're building a big sports ball stadium in the middle of your town. So at the risk of being the annoying libertarian my roads guy here, what about my roads? Isn't physical infrastructure something the government should be spending money to build?
Why you gotta do me like that, Peter?
Because my roads is an important question.
It is an important question
in life and on this podcast.
So,
and this week in Congress.
As always, I like to invoke my hypothetical hierarchical list of things I would abolish roughly in order of importance of abolishing them. And on that hypothetical list, my roads are way down at the bottom, but not as far down, I think, as some people believe. Because when the government invests a lot in infrastructure, yes, people use it. Yes, there might even be a multiplier effect in some limited cases. Certainly historically, I think you can make the case for the interstate system and all that, having been at least effective at achieving its own stated goals. But this is not a scenario in which we say, without this bill, for instance, there would be no roads, right? Like, that is not where we are. And I have very little faith that an extremely large kind of boa constrictor swallowing an elephant sum of money passing into the system is going to be allocated efficiently. The wrong roads are going to get money. The roads that get money are going to be the roads who have powerful, well-connected congressmen arguing for them. We have seen this over and over in the writing of Eric Boehm, for instance, that the federal government is not an ideal entity for figuring out how the correct investments can be made to shore up our national infrastructure. And I don't know why we persist in the delusion that a bunch of people in Washington who are very, very busy right now trying to do partisan point scoring and have stuff to put in their campaign ads in a couple of years, why we think those people are the right people to allocate resources in this matter.
Well, of course, that assumes that the money goes to roads in the first place anyway, right? There's like $80 billion in this bill for Amtrak, and Amtrak has been specifically told in the legislative text not to prioritize routes that make money, but rather to prioritize extending routes to new places. So that means like Eau Claire, Wisconsin gets an Amtrak line for the 10 people that'll use it every year. And that's just, you know, to your point, Catherine, that's just money that's poorly right. allocated.
So the amount of like misinvestment, the amount of misallocated resources in the bill, it's like, as Eric says, all of the Amtrak money is self-evidently wrongly invested, but there are many, many other things that are also not going to be efficiently used. And I think that's the question that libertarians and fans of limited government should always be asking, is if you let people keep this money, would they do something better with it? And the answer to me seems like pretty clearly still to be yes, even in this sort of semi-best case scenario of an infrastructure bill that contains mostly only actually infrastructure projects.
Yeah, can I add to that just the, you know, a couple things. One is the multiplier is a lie. Multiple studies of large scale government investment in the economy and things like that. And Veronique DeRuggi and Robert Bauer have written for this at Mercatus. A lot of that work is shown up at Reason.com. But the government multiplier is generally under one. So, you know, you're spending a dollar to get 80 cents or 60 cents worth of benefit. You've got to be an idiot to pursue that at scale, which is exactly what's going on here. And then to kind of build on both Eric and Catherine's points, if you need a new port or if you need massive increases in capacity and technology and innovation in ports, you don't go to the government. You go to the international conglomerate firms that do this for a living who will come in. They have trillions of dollars of capital to come in and modernize and update ports without taxpayers being on the hook. We also saw this in toll roads. You could do this in airports. You could do this in places which are revenue generators for people who know how to operate them. So this is a colossal waste in at least two ways. One is that there's private capital that would do this better and free to the taxpayer. And then the money that gets spent is actually gets negative returns. I mean, you know, let's jump into something approaching the 21st century, you know, before it's completely gone.
Yeah, I always feel like this argument lacks any sort of thinking about alternatives, because it's like either you're going to spend money on stupid government trains or on stupid government roads. And there's no, you know, I just want to hear like some Elon Musk type be like, where we're going, we won't need roads. And then flip their visor down and fly off into the sky and like sell you a rocket pack. And I'm ready for the rocket pack era. But obviously there will be federal funding for and something related to that. Okay, so let's talk a little bit more just about the way that this bill sets up the next one. Eric, we've been over this just a little bit here, but I want you to respond to the argument that Republicans who voted for the infrastructure bill are making. So, this infrastructure bill in some ways is the first step towards passing a two-part package, right? It's the infrastructure bill, $550 billion in new spending out of a $1.2 trillion bill total. And then it's the partisan budget reconciliation bill at $3.5 trillion. And Republicans say they oppose the second one, the big one. And they say that they are voting for the infrastructure bill in part because they think it will actually constrain that second big bill and it will limit and moderate Democratic spending ambitions. So are Republicans here who are voting for big governments going to succeed in preventing even bigger government somehow? I mean, I will say, like, the one piece of evidence in favor of this argument is that Catherine's fave, Kristen Sinema, has already said she thinks $3.5 trillion might be too much. And when every Democratic senator is going to be required to get on board for this $3.5 trillion bill, maybe, just maybe, it will end up coming in a little bit smaller because they did the infrastructure package first and because they did it on a bipartisan basis.
Yeah. So I think a couple of things here. First, and it's all just going to be cynical politics. So just forewarning that. First, when we talk about Democrats and Republicans in this context, we should be clear that we're really just talking about the Senate. As far as the House is concerned, everything there just passes with a simple majority anyway. So the Republicans don't really have any control over what passes. And for that matter, the House seems to regard these two bills as effectively one package. Nancy Pelosi has more or less said, like, well, no, yeah, I understand that the Senate thinks these two things are separate, but really we're looking at them as one and the same. The House dynamic is different and in some ways more straightforward. Democrats are just going to pass whatever they want. So the Senate dynamic is really the interesting thing here. And that is where this kind of game is being played, of where Republicans, 17 of them, I believe it was, voted for the infrastructure bill. None of them, or so far at least, none of them have come out and said they're going to vote for the larger package that comes next. And that's where they're trying to sort of use the infrastructure bill as a way to limit the influence maybe that Democrats have. Influence is the wrong word here, but they're trying to limit the political support for that other package that Democrats will have to pass via the reconciliation process with a simple majority, which means they can't afford to lose a guy like a Joe Manchin or a Kyrsten Sinema. And so that's where this whole kind of push and pull is happening. And sure, there's a chance that this is in some small way, maybe correct. I think it's mostly disingenuous for Republicans to say that. What I think is mostly happening here is the 17 Republicans who voted for the infrastructure bill want to run for re-election by saying, I voted for roads and bridges, or at least don't want to face attack ads saying they voted against rebuilding bridges and things. But they obviously don't want to vote for the other stuff that's just seen as a pure partisan sort of big government stuff. And so they're just playing that game is really what's going on here. It's not about trying to limit the growth of government. It's not about any sort of high-minded ideals of like, well, certain bills should pass in bipartisan fashion and others, maybe it doesn't matter so much. This is all just cynical politics. And it's the fact that there's some political rate of return for those 17 Republicans who voted yes on the infrastructure bill to do so.
I do think that there are a couple of other factors in play. I think I basically agree with your answer. But just a couple of other things. I think McConnell is trying to protect the filibuster in some ways. And he is doing that by saying, look, bills that need to pass, like infrastructure bills, do pass without having to do anything to the filibuster. So let's make sure we've got enough Republican support for that. I also just think that there is a kind of a deep-rooted, almost mystical allure to bipartisanship in Washington, and in particular in the Senate, where a lot of the old hands view doing big bipartisan stuff, almost independent of what it is, as being part of their job. And that just hasn't happened over the last several years. And so a bunch of folks in the Senate looked at this as an opportunity to prove that the Senate could still be the Senate of their imagination. Okay, so we're going to get to a great reader question about vaccine passports here in just a minute. But before that, a brief word from a sponsor. Living in a digital age where your personal data is always under attack, your online privacy seems to be a thing of the past. Did you know there is a better way that you can protect your information and privacy without worrying about the prying eyes of big tech mining and stealing your private data? Introducing Secure, encrypted instant messaging and secure email service hosted in Switzerland, where the world's strictest data privacy laws are applied. By using proprietary military-grade encryption methods, a proprietary platform, and servers hosted in Switzerland, Secure protects your data from the invasive Cloud Act and other privacy-intrusive measures. Secure email and instant messaging services never seen before in the market today, away from the big tech platforms such as Amazon Web Services, Facebook, WhatsApp, Microsoft, and Google. Take back your privacy and online security with Secure by going to secure.com. That's SEKUR.com. All right, time for our weekly reader question. This one is from Philip, who says that the Roundtable is the first podcast he's ever made into a weekly listening habit. Thank you, Philip. That is a good reminder that not all habit-forming products are bad. Like many libertarians, he says, probably including yourselves, I'm a vaccinated person who is opposed to the idea of government mandates to get vaccines and other medical interventions, where mandate implies get it willingly or armed agents of the state will come strap you to a table and administer it. That idea does not seem to be gaining real traction in the states, at least not yet, but a rash of recent government decrees has left me wondering how much choice people are really being given. First, we have governments acting in their capacity as employers, telling public employees get jabbed or get fired. Second, we have the beginnings in New York City and Los Angeles of barring unvaccinated people from much of public life and business by government decree. So the question, and I'm going to go to you, Nick, first. The question is, am I crazy to think that these are just backdoor vaccine mandates? And if they are, how can libertarians push back on the notion that the mere lack of armed enforcement makes them okay? Nick, you live in New York City. How do you think about this sort of thing?
One thing today, the beginning of the New York City passport vaccine went into effect. It's going to take a month to kind of shake out what the actual details are. One thing that's fascinating about it is that if this is a public health measure, you can't eat indoors and you can't go to gyms and you can't go to, indoor theater venues without vaccines and masks. But you can go to the grocery store, which seems kind of odd if it's actually about kind of maintaining public health and whatnot. I think that, the fundamental mistake that's going on in terms of public health right now is that the government is dictating the level of risk that citizens and business owners should be allowed to kind of deuce for themselves. So I do see this as an attempt to kind of squeeze out of public life. And actually, Bill de Blasio, in his discussion, the mayor of New York, in his discussion of the purpose of this kind of activity or this kind of action on the part of government, expressly said that this is your ticket, it's your ticket to participating in all the greatness that is New York. So it is a way of kind of channeling people into this or that kind of government behavior. I think that's wrong. I don't know where it ends exactly, because I also think that one of the things that's going on now, a lot of people are clearly pushing for a lockdown, a second lockdown, and a more robust kind of cramping of people's abilities to do whatever they want because of the Delta variant. I think this is the fight right now. Do we learn to live with a certain level of infection and get on with things, or do we go back to this kind of semi-permanent state of not being allowed to to do what we want on our own terms?
Catherine, on a scale of 1, representing a full month of masked mandatory 6 a.m. Trips to the gym, to 10, representing a quiet, perfectly white room with a brand new Neal Stephenson novel, how excited are you about Washington, D.C. making you enter a bunch of personal health information into an app so that you can go with me to a new cocktail bar?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that's lurking down around like a 3.5 for me on that scale of Catherine sadness to happiness. But I think the letter writer is really onto something here, which is that I have this very strong impulse, and I think many libertarians do, to say, listen, we just need to sort out which things are public and which things are private. And then it'll be clear, it'll sort of cascade from there, which entities can appropriately require vaccination and which ones cannot. And the trouble, and this is like not a new libertarian complaint, right? This idea that too many things in our lives, which were formerly clearly private actions, private choices, private institutions, have become blurrily public, have become hybridized with the state in some confusing way. Maybe it happened a long time ago, maybe it happened recently, and that makes the judgment about the sphere of appropriate action for those entities much more difficult. Now, of course, we're seeing that debate play out, I think, in a misguided way in the question about social media. Is because, Facebook's muckety-mucks get dragged in by Congress and scolded, is the chilling effect caused by the threat of government and regulation? Does that mean that essentially those things are the government? I think the answer there is clearly no. But at the same time, we do have, for instance, you know, governments acting in their capacity as employers. That was an example that the letter writer brought up. And in that instance, I actually think that it's that we could consider a vaccine mandate appropriate there. To me, the distinction and the way that I draw the line is, can a person opt out without losing the ability to do basic life functions or to face violence? So you can quit your job as a school teacher and get another job. Therefore, it is okay to me to have a vaccine mandate for school teachers, or, as many employers are doing, provide some secondary option like weekly testing that protects the safety of people who use those services. You know, I think that that is the question, is I am fine with a vaccine mandate anywhere that someone can choose not to do the thing. So I am not fine with a vaccine mandate to walk down a public street because I have to walk down public streets. But I am fine with a vaccine mandate to go to Peter Suderman's favorite cocktail bars because, as much as I would like to go to them, I don't have to go to them. This question of a government-sponsored and managed tool to check your vaccination, I don't like, and I think is going to go badly, and I would much rather figure out third-party systems. There are such things as third-party health records that exist. This is not a crazy libertarian idea. It's a thing that already exists. And I would like for individual retail locations, gyms, whatever, you know, there could be a robust market there for those entities to figure out how to check your vaccination without requiring each individual employee to be an expert in eyeballing people's vaccination cards. There are ways besides involving the state, but it is tricky when we live in a world where the state has involved itself in all kinds of things that should by all rights be private.
Speaking of third-party health records, it just reminds me that the Obama stimulus way back in 2009 included tens of billions of dollars for electronic health records, the idea being that, oh, look, this would help transition us out of a world of paper records. And you remember all those like giant filing systems that hospitals in some cases still have, but certainly used to have, where they were motorized. And it looked like, you know, like the end of a Pixar movie, right? Just like all of these like machines, like moving paper around.
It's like a dry cleaner,
right?
Yeah.
And the idea was, first of all, we're going to be able to get rid of that. Second of all, we're going to be able to move to health records that can be easily shared between hospitals and states and regions. So if you move, or if you happen to be in California for work and you live in Texas, then, you know, your California hospital that you need to go to that week, if something happens, they're going to be able to get easy access to your records. And of course, they spent tons and tons of money on consultants who put new systems into all the hospitals, and then none of them talk to each other. And it was a complete disaster from a data interoperability perspective, which was the whole thing that it was supposed to solve. So, Eric, before we leave this topic, I do want to ask you, since you, I think, have a somewhat different personal experience with some of this, because if you will allow me to reveal a little bit of your personal life here, at the beginning of the pandemic, you moved an hour or two away from sort of the inside the Beltway, Washington, D.C. area to a smaller town where I gather things are a little bit different. None of this sort of talk seems to be taking hold. So does any of this faze you personally? And is the implication here that we should all just move to a small town in Virginia?
Yes, everyone should move out of D.C. for sure. I don't know about moving out of every city, but everybody should move out of D.C. Yeah, I mean, this is the thing that sort of that I get stuck on with this is that I just don't understand how this is really workable. There are many people who don't live in live in a big city, but commute in and out on a regular basis. I don't think those people are going to adopt something like that. There's so many questions about the way in which this system would be adopted and enforced, and whether, for example, bars and restaurants even have much of an incentive to actually enforce it against their patrons who are coming in and paying money. I am very skeptical of that. I also am sort of very skeptical that we could ever have some sort of system that would limit who gets on like airplanes or something to based on your vaccination status, just because I don't think the airlines are going to stand for that, because they're going to be the ones who are going to have to turn people away at the gate and face that anger from. And so, I don't know, the whole thing seems just completely unworkable to me, maybe outside of like deep blue metro areas where everyone is just fully bought into like this is our lives forever. And then I also just as sort of philosophically, I wonder about the justification for this right now, because on one hand, we're being told that there are all these breakthrough infections, and there really aren't. There are very few breakthrough infections, but we're being told that we need, you know, new mask mandates because even people who have had the vaccine and are vaccinated, fully vaccinated, can still spread the infection, can still spread the virus. And so we have to have more mask mandates in places. But then also we're being told that, oh, if you show your vaccination status to get into a bar or a concert venue, and if everyone does that, then we will have created a safe space where everyone in here has proved that they're vaccinated. But wait a minute, you literally just told me that vaccinated people can still spread the infection, and that's why we need other restrictions on how we behave in public. So I don't know, it all seems to just sort of cut against itself. And also, I think that by the time anything kind of gets off the ground, the Delta wave will be behind us. And so hopefully all this just kind of fades into the background and we forget about it 6 weeks from now.
One parallel is the fact that you have to, you know, the longstanding requirement to, in theory, to show your ID to enter bars or buy alcohol at bars. And that has been a decades long battle in forcing enforcement by those venues through threatening their very existence, right? By threatening they're taking to take away their license.
Right, because you can lose
even,
your license.
And in that case, there is still at least a relatively close tie between the sale of alcohol, the theoretical requirement for showing an ID, and the desire to kind of achieve this public safety end of like preventing young people from drinking and presumably driving in most cases. Here, there are like three more steps removed. It is theoretically a temporary problem. And even with all those other threats in place, compliance of carding people at bars is still far from 100%. So I think.
But it's come on, seriously, have you ever been turned away when you were underage?
I mean, I was.
It's pretty good. It's pretty robust.
I was a good kid, Nick. I didn't try to go to bars when I was underage.
But I'm just saying, if we're being serious, the certification of showing that you're legal drinking age works pretty well in most places. I don't
After
think it's
decades
a
of work,
to add.
Though. I mean, it wasn't.
But it's in place. It's in place, and like adding a vaccination card, and then yanking restaurants or theater venues licenses and things like that if they fail to comply. In New York, when outdoor dining started last year, there was a stupid requirement saying that you had to provide food as well as other things. A bunch of bars that tried to skirt that by serving bags of potato chips or popcorn, they got their license pulled. A couple of them didn't open again. I suspect that all you have to do is threaten a few restaurants or a few businesses, and there's going to be higher than average compliance. I think part of what's the problem here is that it's an extension of the idea that people who are not vaccinated are somehow the enemy. They're dumb, they're stupid, and they need to be forced to do something. The government has done a fantastically awful job, as have most health experts, of actually explaining why these vaccines are good and workable and, you know, trying to attract flies with honey rather than vinegar. And this continues to a point where the New York Times just ran a piece a couple days ago about it's something like 27% of blacks in New York between the ages of 18 and 44 are vaccinated. A vast minority, less than a third of the people. Those people are going to be summarily dismissed from large parts of public life. And when you listen to the answer, the reasons they give for not being vaccinated, they're not, you know, living in an alternative reality. They're just like, they need to be convinced. And instead of convincing them, what we're going to do is punish them by saying, okay, you can't come in here. You can't come in here. You're evil. You're a malingerer. You're, you know, a kulak, a vaccine kulak or something like that. And that, I mean, the discourse needs to change around that if we actually want to get to a point where we have 70, 80, 90% of people vaccinated, which we do for other types of diseases.
So I will just say that when I worked as a server at a seafood restaurant in Florida in the late 1990s and early aughts, we had to go through alcohol sales training, and they warned us that the state had recently changed the laws so that if you got caught selling to a minor, it used to be that they would just sort of give you a ticket and you'd maybe have to report to the courthouse, something like that. But in uh, the starting sometime in the 1990s, they changed it so that they would actually handcuff you and frog march you out of the restaurant in front of all your colleagues and all of the customers. And they did stings pretty regularly throughout the year, and they would actually catch people at gas stations, at bars, at restaurants, selling to minors that the state had sent out to attempt to purchase alcohol, sometimes with no ID, but sometimes with a state-created fake ID. So the prospect of being thrown in jail because you didn't have time to check the ID of somebody who looked like an adult and you were busy trying to serve your customers was something I actually had to think about on a pretty regular basis. Okay, we are going to move on to our end of show recommendations here. But before we get to the meat of this segment, I just want to say that I personally am consuming a gigantic yard sign with my own words on it. It says, "In this house, we believe in science," and then there's an asterisk. An iterative process of argument and disagreement that never fully resolves anything, which of course is a reference to a joke I made on this podcast several episodes back about wanting my own version of one of those "In this house, we believe science is real" yard signs. And so this alternate version was made by the great listener Frederick from California, sent to the Reason DC office in a huge, expertly wrapped package, almost like a giant holiday card to me. So Frederick from California, thank you so, so much. Everything about this sign is just delightful, and it is going to earn a prominent place of display next to my desk. Nick, let's start with you. What have you been watching, reading, and otherwise consuming this week?
So my consumption this week is a book called Spooked by the journalist Barry Meyer, and it is about the rise of private security investigation services in journalism and whatnot. And it's a fantastic read. It talks about the subtitle name checks the Trump dossier, the Steele dossier, Black Cube, and the rise of other private spies. Black Cube was a Israeli-based a private investigation company that came to light during the Harvey Weinstein stuff. He used them to dig up dirt on his accusers. They're not really a main player in the book. It really has to do with Fusion GPS, the group that was started by former journalists at the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere that generated the Steele dossier for the Clinton campaign, for the Hillary Clinton campaign. And this was the the document that ultimately got published by BuzzFeed. Talked about the P tape, the idea that there was video of Donald Trump exhorting prostitutes to urinate on a bed that had been used by Barack Obama in Russian hotels. This book is fantastic. It is it's nonfiction, but it reads like a summer thriller, a beach read. And it talks about the way in which Russiagate and particularly the Steele dossier was circulated without any verification or any validation as a means of kind of destabilizing the Trump presidency, even before he took office. And for that reason, it's a good read because Trump, I was not a fan of Trump. I think he was on balance, a terrible president, not necessarily that much worse than those who immediately preceded him or the one who is immediately coming after him. But we've already started to forget about how much Russiagate, the idea that Trump was either a total dupe of the Kremlin or was actively working as an agent of Putin and Putin's interest because of kompromat against him, dominated, the entirety of at least the first two or three years of his presidency. This book holds journalists accountable. It holds people in other positions of power accountable, politicians. And I would recommend reading Spooked. It's a great primer in kind of new media literacy that we need to be taking more seriously than ever.
Eric, what about you?
I guess there's a theme here on like spies and intelligence. I will talk about a book I read a few weeks ago called this actually came out several years ago, so it's a little old, but it's Washington Spies, The Story of America's First Spy Ring by the historian Alexander Rose. It was actually the basis for a kind of short-lived AMC series called Turn, which I watched the first few episodes of, and it didn't really grip me, but I thought, oh, there's an interesting idea here. I want to go read the book, and the book is fascinating. It's about a spy ring that operated in coastal Connecticut during the sort of later stages of the American Revolution, sneaking messages out of New York City, which is where most of the British generals were for the later stages of the war, out through rural Long Island, across the Long Island Sound into Connecticut, and then ultimately up into the Hudson Valley, where Washington and the American generals were camping for most of those last few years of the war. But the most interesting part, and this, with all the talk this week about Afghanistan, I think is even more relevant, is the reasons. The book goes into kind of the cultural dynamics on Long Island in the 1770s. And one of the reasons why the British chose New York as their sort of home base during their operations in trying to subdue the American Revolution is because Long Island was full of people who were mostly loyal to the crown. It was a hotbed of kind of Toryism during the Revolution, as opposed to New England and Philadelphia, which tended to be much more, you know, towards the revolutionary side of things. And the book kind of traces through one of the main characters who becomes really central to the spy ring. He comes from a family that was a loyalist family, went to a church that was a loyalist church, actually agitated against the revolution prior to 1776, was never, you know, sort of all that vocal about it, but was clearly someone who believed that America's best interests were in remaining with the British crown. But as the years of the war wear on, and as the kind of destruction of Long Island at the hands of the British army, who are, I mean, they're not doing anything, they're not pillaging the countryside, but they're eating out, you know, all of the farms on Long Island. They're destroying the kind of commerce that goes on there, just the sort of ongoing encampment of a foreign army, and the way that interferes with your daily life ultimately turned him and his family to the point where they became spies for the American Revolution, not because they believed in the cause of freedom or the Declaration of Independence or anything, but just because they wanted the British army gone. And it kind of traces that thread through not just his family, but kind of culturally through people who didn't necessarily have a stake one way or the other in the war, but who saw that this like encampment by a foreign army was just not working for us. And so turned against the British and helped sort of turn the tide of the revolution.
Sounds like a job for the Third Amendment Lawyer Society. Catherine, what about you?
I am calling in actually from Long Island, where I can testify to the
Are you being quartered?
I am a soldier being quartered in my mother-in-law's house. Although I think that she may be secretly conspiring against me, since I got a small injury and went to find some Neosporin and found a bottle of Neosporin that was purchased around the time that the U.S. originally went into Afghanistan.
Wow.
So I think that, that stuff doesn't they've turned bad. On us is what I'm saying here on Long Island. It makes perfect sense.
Long Island was also a hotbed, and I don't know how this would play into Eric's thesis, but the Bund movement. It was filled with Nazi sympathizers that sold out Madison Square Garden several nights in a row in the 30s. So I don't know. Absent Lou Reed, there's
Long
not
Island
a lot cut
bad,
good
maybe.
From Long
I
Island.
Will, I will do further research and report back. And if you don't hear from me again, I guess the folks out here listened to this podcast and realized we're onto them. What I'm consuming is that I finished the Emily Oster book that I touted on last week's podcast. And I got to tell you guys, it is so good. I recognize again that it plays to all my biases, but like a bunch of data and also a bunch of kind of like you can make your family run better if you just use Google Docs correctly speaks to my heart. I hope it speaks to yours. But when I finished that book, I closed it on my Kindle app and the algorithm said, do you want to reread Dune? And I said to the algorithm, I just might. So I reopened Dune, took a look. I read Dune too late. I think that Dune is one of those books that if you read it when you are a disaffected 12-year-old boy, that it really can hit you in the heart. I read Ender's Game in that moment in my life instead, and it functioned much in the same way, but it is a different path. You do, you know, you choose which, you know, tween who can save the world you're going to swear allegiance to, and then you can never really change. So I remain always a little bit of a Dune skeptic, but I'm guessing that there are Dune fans on this podcast and certainly among our listenership. I also think that it's important not to blame a book that creates a genre or that sort of is an anchor in a genre for the cliches of the genre. And when I reopened the first book of Dune and looked in there and was immediately greeted by this like meta, like our hero knew that many of these strange words would be words he would have to learn. And you're like, okay, calm down here, Frank Herbert. Like, I will learn your stupid apostrophe-ed words, but you don't got to be so meta about it. But talk me out of my, you know, middle-aged skepticism of this young man's book and tell me why I should dive back in.
I want to just point out that Dune is responsible, a book that I hate and a world that I hate, is responsible for one of the greatest moments of modern cinema, which is when Sting emerges from the mid-80s movie version by David Lynch and delivers what is possibly the single worst line reading in cinema when he says, "I will kill him." Look it up. You can find massive dozens of versions of it. It's almost up there with, you know, Bruno Ganz worrying about the end of the Nazi regime as Adolf Hitler. It's, you know, the "I will kill him" line from the David Lynch version of Dune as articulated by Sting is a great thing, and it's worth suffering through all of Dune and God Emperor Dune and parking attendant lot of Dune, all of that kind of stuff, and for that 130 seconds.
To be clear, on the off chance that our listeners have been like living under a sand dune, the reason that my algorithm
in fear of sandworms,
spoilers. The reason my algorithm suggested this book to me is because there is, of course, a new edition to correspond with the release of the movie starring Timothée Chalamet and Zendaya and basically everyone who has like a tan and a beard in all of Hollywood.
Oscar Isaac's beard in the trailers for that, it's like the size of this podcast booth, which admittedly not that big, but real big for a beard. No, the best thing about the David Lynch version of Dune is that Patrick Stewart is in it just a couple of years before he started doing Star Trek The Next Generation. It was one of his first big film roles. And the amazing thing is Patrick Stewart has not aged one single day since his appearance in Dune in 1984.
Well, it's a dry heat. Right? You know, it's a dry heat on Dune, so...
He has been the driest captain of the Enterprise of my heart for all of my life. So I will finish just by saying that I also saw Free Guy, new movie about a background video game character, an NPC or non-playable character who comes alive and discovers his soul and his reason for being. It's sort of an AI Pinocchio set in a fake Fortnite world. This movie's gotten a lot of very good reviews, and I did not like it. It felt very forced and calculated to me, and it weirdly decides to run all of its, like, here's the AI people who you hadn't noticed, but they're, like, coming alive, and they're individuals, and they have personalities. It runs it through, like, a very shallow and thin sort of labor politics. Like, at the end, the NPCs go on strike, and there's the B-plot is all about a couple of indie game designers with, like, a nonviolent waterfall game that's really innovative, but some big, bad corporate guy stole their IP. And so it's literally the stakes in this movie are whether indie game designers will get their residuals or not. It's not very good. It's an empty sort of spot the reference game, especially the end. The most interesting and worst thing about it is, and this is a little bit of a spoiler, so you can shut this off right now if you don't want any, but the most interesting thing is just the way that this 20th Century Studios movie, which is to say it is from the legacy of 20th Century Fox, which now is owned by Disney, which of course also owns Marvel and Star Wars and all of that, right? Yes.
This podcast, yes, if we're being honest, or it's in negotiations to buy this podcast.
Incorporates a whole bunch of IP from the Disney-verse, right? A Marvel, Star Wars stuff just sort of starts popping up in this movie at the very end. And so you see the fully operational Disney Death Star here with regards to exploiting IP and just sort of dropping all the entire universe into every single product. Okay, so that is all we have.
I find, if I may, Peter, I'm not going to watch that movie hearing your review of it, but I had seen a bunch of trailers that were completely inscrutable. And it became a Rorschach test of, do you want to see Ryan Reynolds not in full body makeup like he was in Deadpool, which is the only movie I think I've liked Ryan Reynolds in.
Yeah,
so it's like it's a weird,
the appeal to that movie is just solely
it is very much
and not really funny, but seeming to be making humorous lines that maybe you would understand if you watched the movie, but
doing his like confused. Yeah.
It's very
meta
much
Ryan Reynolds
in PG-13 yeah. Deadpool mode. And I guess if you really love that, you might find something appealing here. But I certainly did not. That is all the time we have today, folks. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with Matt Welch once again in the big chair. Until then, happy Monday.